Some say we can't fix the injustice of the food chain by simply voting with our dollars. To really get the job done right, we must take to the streets and force change. And so we ask, can political activism bring social justice to food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, thank you, Will Strickland, and hello out there. You are tuned into the 1119th edition of the Food Chain right here in the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Punta Arenas who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Good. Hello.
So, quick question, Jason. Have you ever participated in a protest march?
I don't believe in protest, but I don't know how to show it.
Okay, very good. But you don't know how to protest it, right?
Right.
Okay, folks, the statue of Lady Justice, you remember the one, you know, she's standing there. She's got, she's holding a scale to weigh the relative merits of an argument, and she's wearing a blindfold to maintain her impartiality. Well, you know, if there was such a thing as the statue of Lady Social Justice, she would likely be carrying an axe and sporting an angry scowl, as did that champion of temperance, Carrie Nation. When it comes to the actual social justice of food, some, like our guest today, say consumers have done a lot to improve food quality by voting with their dollars. After all, their dollars have brought fresh organic food to our front door. But for one reason or another, the dollars did not bring social justice to the food of all. So, our guest, along with many others, suggests a new food activism is required to make things right. This new food activism leads us to ask today, can political activism bring social justice to food? Here to help us weigh in on this question, we have Julie Guthman, who is a professor of community studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, my alma mater, where I took a degree in English and Chinese literature, and I'm still trying to figure out what the heck to do with it. And she's also co-author of The New Food Activism. Julie, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thank you. I so appreciate you having me on your show today.
Always enjoy it, because we always get into good conversations. Matter of fact, nearly 7 years ago, we had a great conversation about the politics of obesity. And of course, in having that conversation, we ended obesity, did we not?
Oh, of course.
Didn't quite work out that way. We also had a question of the day when I looked back at my notes of that show. And the question of the day was which can best feed the hungry, socialism or capitalism? But I forgot who won the argument. Do you remember?
I don't remember who won that argument.
Probably still raging, right?
It's still raging.
Okay, good. Well, folks, you know, advocates of capitalism say let people vote with their dollars and things will kind of take care of themselves. But advocates of socialism say voting with dollars will never adequately address the social injustice of the food chain, and therefore we must take to the streets and organize. And so there we are. That's the question of the day. Can political activism bring social justice to food? You know, Julian, in thinking about, you make your statement with the new food activism by granting that so much change has been made by people voting with their dollars. And I think, you know, I'd like to start the show here today with that, because as I scan the horizon, in fact, I'm planning a show about the big food brands of the United States. You know, the Kellogg's, the Nestle, and so on and so on and so on. They all seem to be in deep doo-doo because less and less people are buying their brands. So it seems to me like we have done some good by voting with our dollars.
Well, sure. Let me just say, I mean, by voting with our dollars, what I'm really referring to is the many kind of approaches to food system chain where consumers are supposed to voice their preferences for food produced more sustainably or in presumably more socially just ways by purchasing organic or local or fair trade products. That's the sort of thing I'm referring to with voting for with our dollars. And there's no question that those movements have a lot of resonance in the public imagination. And organic in particular has grabbed a lot of attention. But one of the things that's really interesting is that while about 60 or 70% of the American population claim that they buy organic food once a year or so, only about 1% of acreage in the United States is under organic production.
Mm-hmm.
So that suggests some sort of disconnect between what people say they do or where the kind of conversation in the United States is about food and what's actually happening on the ground. So while I think that the organic movement and others have changed sensibilities about food and certainly have allowed some people to eat quite well, there's clear limits to buying food, buying and choosing with your dollar as a way to change, to transform the food system.
You know, with respect to only 1% of the acreage in the United States being in organic production, I believe that's true. And I believe it's true, but I also believe it's true that a significant percentage of the organic food in the United States is now imported.
That's
some
correct.
Some people say it's as much as 85% of the organic food here in the United States has been imported, which to me, like, that's incredible. Why is it so extensive?
I have a hard time believing that figure. I have not seen that figure, but I could be wrong. Something like, 1% of the acreage is an organic and 5% of sales is organic. So clearly the sales is reflecting imports, and it's also reflecting the value added between what's produced on the farm.
Right.
And, and what happens in the factory. I have a hard time imagining 85%, because what are we talking about? We're talking about coffee, bananas, sugar, we're talking about...
Grains. From what I understand, those people who raise organic chickens, produce organic eggs, are having to import their organic grain from, like, India. And, that seems like an injustice to me.
Well, I've never heard this before, to be honest. I mean, you could be right, but of the organic growers I've spoken with, and I've talked to quite a few who grow organic pasture or mm-hmm. organic livestock, at least the ones in California, I have never heard of them importing grains. But I don't know, and it's not something I've actually looked at.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with all due respect, most of us who want to eat better look at ways of eating better and find it in the food chain, whether it's organic food, but whether we go the even extra mile and we look for pasture raised livestock, free range livestock, we look for foods that have been grown with the environment in mind, not just organic but regenerative agriculture, that seeks to rebuild the earth as we grow our food. There's so many things that we can do to vote with our dollar, and they have been changing the way we eat, have they not?
They have changed the way some people eat, but the question is who gets to vote with their dollar under what circumstances? And products that are like organic or fair trade's a little different, but let's use organic because it's a great example. They're designed to be more expensive. The way the organic label works is that growers who agree to comply with organic standards and agree to comply and go through the rigmarole of organic certification expect to be rewarded in the marketplace with a price premium for their products. And so that's why Not all, but that's why many organic growers choose to grow organically. And it's not even necessarily that they're searching for higher prices, but they need those higher prices to compensate for the cost of more rotations, you know, the
right.
letting go of the yield. So it's going to, not all crops, but many crops, it's going to cost more to grow organically. So that leaves consumers out who can't afford higher food prices.
Mm-hmm. So
and one of the things that's been, just if you let me just finish this thought.
Sure, go ahead.
It's been really interesting is during the recession that now seems a while back, but that recession during 2007 to 2009, the market for organics fell considerably because, you know, people didn't have income in
right.
their pocket. So we have a system that's based, that's very tied to business cycles and is assuming that people can afford to buy organic food.
And that, so what do we do if they can't afford to buy organic food? That is the question on the table today. Can food activism change that dynamic so that those who are left out of the means to buy those high-priced foods can find a way in? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Julie Guthman. She's the co-author of The New Food Activism and You. 831-479-1080 is the call-in number today. Love to hear what you have to say. We will be right back.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it. Metro farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it. Metro farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it. Metro farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it. Metro farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it. Metro farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it. Metro farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, What's Eating What is we are eating a lot more organic food and food that's natural and food that is grown with regenerative agriculture and is all of those things. My goodness. And we're spending big money with them to the extent that those big, huge food companies like Nestle and Kellogg's and on and on and on are kind of like in a panic, not knowing what to do other than buy up everything that has an organic label on it. Well, with respect to organic, we know exactly what it means because it's a government issued word now. But we don't know what sustainable means, and we're not sure what natural means, and the one that's often confusing for me is social justice and injustice. And here to help us work that out, we have Julie Guthman, who is a professor of community studies, and she teaches social justice. So, Julie, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about social justice?
Well, in respect to food systems, when I use the term social justice, I'm referring to good pay, better pay for workers, better working conditions for workers, and not only in farm work, but in all food work. I'm referring to the use of fewer or lesser toxic chemicals, so workers and others are not subject to health problems from the production of food, referring to making sure that farmers themselves earn a livelihood, and we're talking about making or trying to have consumers have food that's affordable and healthy and accessible. Now, all those things are often in tension, which is why it's so difficult to attain social justice in food systems, because if you pay workers more, it costs more, and then consumers can't afford it. And if you have a food that's affordable to consumers, then it may, then maybe the prices don't sustain farmers. So those are really difficult things to attain all at once, and that's one of the limitations to efforts to vote with your dollar. So in the book that I co-edited with my with Allison Alcon, who's the co-editor, we're not suggesting that everything requires a protest, but we're saying that we need a lot more attention to the policy environment. So some of those tensions between environmental sustainability, food access for consumers, for low-income consumers, and wages and adequate income for farmers and farm workers can somehow be met more fairly.
Mm-hmm. You know, I often thought that my basic principle of life is that everything should cost what it costs, and things will work out. And I often looked at the farm worker situation, as I have for many years here on the Central California Central Coast, and thought that, well, they're always going to be cheap. They're always going to be paid cheap wages because, you know, the borders open and there's a never-ending stream of cheap labor willing to take the work. And wondered about that, thinking that if they close the borders and those who are here would have to be paid what it costs them to live, and that would, things would kind of even out that way. Does that make any sense?
Well, it kind of makes sense, but that's not the current reality. It's true that historically one of the reasons that farm workers were paid so poorly is because there was an excess supply of farm workers. But that was purposefully done. The farm organizations and agribusiness tried to create those circumstances.
Right, exactly.
They advertised for more jobs than they were available, and they used farm labor contractors to bring people to bring people for jobs that were not available so they could have a surplus of laborers and pay low. And there's a long history of that, but that's actually really changed, and our borders are not open. They are closed, and they're fortified, militarily, and that's actually...
Well, don't you think that'll even out wages then? If farmers have to pay true cost of labor, don't you think farm workers will have to be paid more? And people will have to pay more for food.
Well, that's an interesting question, because let's say since about the mid-90s, when the border became more fortified and more militarized, people have to risk their lives to cross that border, and they have to risk being deported, or if they're crossing in, say, Arizona, where about 1,000 or 1,500 people die every year in the desert just trying to cross the border. So crossing the border is a pretty scary thing.
Unless we had an official labor exchange program, as
right,
we once
which
did.
Which we don't. And so it's a very dangerous thing to cross the border, and nobody wants to get deported. And so that makes for a very compliant workforce who are willing to take poor wages or to be sexually harassed, which happens routinely in farm work, or to not have to not get adequate equipment for pesticides. This happens routinely. But now it's interesting, because I've been doing a lot of research on the strawberry industry, and growers complain vehemently about the labor shortage because of the border.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are wages going up? Not a lot, surprisingly.
Well, I've heard if you're a good strawberry picker, you can make pretty good wages, and, you know, just driving through the strawberry fields, as I do have an occasion to do, and I look out and see their cars, and they look like pretty nice cars. So I don't know what they're being paid, but it looks like they're being paid much more than when I pick strawberries.
Well, they're paid on a mix of wages and piece rates. And so if you're extremely fast, and I'm talking about packing, I think, something like six of those boxes that mm-hmm. has about 12 little baskets.
If you're a good picker, you get paid well, and if you're a bad picker, you get paid poorly.
Exactly, if you keep your job at all. And those workers are literally running through the fields to pick quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And they often have all sorts of health issues, back pain, because they're stooped over. So I would say that strawberry work is super lucrative, and people who can get out of it when they can. And that's one of the reasons that the strawberry industry is seeing the worst labor shortage, because it's kind of the worst conditions in farm labor.
Yeah. I bet sooner or later they're going to figure out how to grow strawberries vertically, in which case you wouldn't have to bend over and everybody would be much more happy.
They're working on it in some areas. That's a topic for another show.
That certainly is. Yeah. Well, you know, we're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes, but when we come back, one of the things you said while giving a speech there on the East Coast, you're in Boston, right?
I am in Boston.
Now, what's a West Coaster doing on the East Coaster there as a university professor? Are you exchanging, are you kind of like a hummingbird exchanging pollen from flower to flower?
Well, that's a wonderful metaphor. I have the very good fortune of being at the Radcliffe Institute, which is a year-long, academic year-long fellowship, where I am able to work on a book on the strawberry industry.
Oh, wow.
I'm so lucky to have a Guggenheim Fellowship, too, so I really hit the jackpot this year, so I'm taking a year off to work on this book.
Well, good for you, and we look forward to that book on the strawberry industry, living as we do amidst that strawberry industry. But, while on the East Coast, you made a speech, and there's something in the speech that I picked up, and I'll quote it here, and when we get back from the break, we'll pick it up and have a discussion about it. We must make food justice more culturally relevant. The organic food movement has not resonated with people of color. And I read that and I thought, I don't quite understand why not. I don't understand, because what we're talking about is good food for all people. And all people are kind of anatomically alike, might have different skin color, different ethnic backgrounds, but goodness, we're all people and we all eat food. So why the disconnect between African-American community, people of color, and organic food? So we'll pick that up when we come back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is The Food Chain radio program. Michael Olson, and today we are talking about food activism with Julie Guthman, co-author of The New Food Activism, talking about whether we can force change, I guess, on the food chain to make it more just for everybody. But before we go back to the big question that I have, which is the cultural relevancy of organic food and what food justice can and how food activism can make that relevant, I'd like to go to Rory, who is a strawberry guy and probably would know about the justice of farm labor a little bit, at least from his side of the story. Rory, welcome to the food chain.
Well, thank you, Michael, and good to be on with your guest. I'm not the end all. I see what I see in the fields. And there is a labor shortage. It's been tight for 5 years, very tight. Your guests, though, might want to update her info. Number one, they hardly pick into those 12-pint basket boxes anymore. There's still some, very little. Mostly it's either 4 2-pounders or 2 4-pounders or 8 1-pounders. And the going rate right now is like $5.50 an hour base pay once you hit volume, and anywhere from $1.40 to $1.50 a crate. And the reason those people are running is because that's how they make more money. And the young guys set up competitions. They're not supposed to run, but you can't stop them. And they literally hustle because the faster they work, the more they make. And they have informal competitions going on all the time. So the strawberry pickers are doing well. I'll tell you a quick story. I had a client from out of town from the southern hemisphere, and they looked at all the vehicles, and the wife asked, are those the pickers' vehicles? I said, yeah. She goes, oh, those are pretty nice cars, because where their strawberry pickers come from, they don't have cars, period. So We got it pretty good here. It's not terrible. I believe in the market. If you look at the cost of production and yield on organics, you pay more, you get less yield, but typically it pays in the market. This year, there was a lot of time when the organic price for crate of berries was only a dollar more than the conventional. So it ebbs and flows, but I believe let people make their own decision. We don't need top-down government everywhere. We need some regulation, but we don't need... I'll give you a quick example. One of the state senators in Southern California, in her wisdom, decided that the 10-hour day in agriculture was unfair and wrong. So they did away with it. So now you got to pay time and a half after 8 hours per day and probably 40 hours per week. Well, they never consulted with the people that are actually doing the work. They don't like it because they look at that. It's like, hey, you're taking away my ability to make money because the growers are going to say, hey, I'm not getting paid more money for this fruit. So they're going to shrink their operation from a 10-hour day to an 8-hour day. So who loses? Actual pickers do. And the price is not going to change a lot because it's the price is the price depending on the supply.
Well, you know, there's always that about the unintended consequences of good intentions.
So right. I'm just curious what your guest thought about that.
Let's ask her. Thank you very much for the call, Roy. Julie, what about the unintended consequences of trying to end the 10-hour day?
Well, first of all, I just really appreciate Rory's perspective. And, you know, I've been studying the strawberry industry for 4 years now, and I am very, very sympathetic to the challenges of the industry. And the book I'm writing is really thinking about that. Now, the 10-hour day, yes, I've heard growers complain about the unintended consequences of new rules around working hours. I've not heard workers complain about them. So, you know, now Rory is clearly close to the workers. He hears what his workers say, and I don't doubt that what they say to him, but I just think that we need to have all kind of perspectives on the table when we think about what is fairness in the labor market. And it is true that workers can make a lot of money in a day or by the hour if they work very, very quickly. But again, not all workers are capable of working that quickly. And there's a lot of women workers too that cannot keep up with those men that are running those competitions he was referring to.
Well, you know, I guess that's a good place to pick up social justice then. Is there a way of equaling out that disparity between energetic young men and other people who can't pick as fast? Would it be just to make everybody earn the same thing? Or would that be unfair to the young men?
That would be called an hourly wage, mm-hmm. right? Now, in many industries, you're paid by the hour, and the strawberry industry, some growers use only piece rate, and some use a combination of piece work and piece rate and hourly wages, depending on the time of year. But hourly wages guarantees that everybody gets the same thing.
Is that just?
You know, I think it's more just, but I do understand that some workers would prefer to work really fast and make a lot of money. You know, for me, it's you know, the justice issue is about my concern is addressing some of these challenges, like having a berry that's accessible to consumers, like making sure that farmers can make a living. And not on the backs of workers. And I don't think it can be done simply through the market. I do think we need policy to address these issues, you know, way far beyond strawberries as well. And that's kind of the motivation.
Well, yeah, well let's take it.
Much of my work.
Yeah, let's take it beyond strawberries here because, like I said, one of the things you said in a speech on the East Coast, we must make food justice more culturally relevant. The organic food movement has not resonated with people of color. Well, why not?
Okay, I'd like to take that up, and I don't remember which talk on the East Coast you're referring to. That's fine. No, I mean, you know, the organic movement and what I call the alternative food movement more generally has really arose from kind of what I'm going to call white privileged people. And that, and you know, there, this is true of the environmental movement more generally, and that's why we've seen an environmental justice movement of sometimes the leadership of certain movements and organizations tends to be white. And so part of it has to do with just, like, the literal appearance of people who have been involved in the food movement have been largely white. But, you know, but it's... Go ahead.
So what you're saying is that people of color look at people who are advocating organic farming or the environment and say, oh, just a bunch of honkies.
Well,
something like that.
Maybe not, but it's more than that. And I do want to say this is changing in part because of critiques like mine, and it's because the activists recognize this as well. But here's the thing. It's not only that the leadership and the people involved in the movement are white. It's also that many of the idioms, the ideas that have kind of animate the alternative food movement kind of come from white cultural histories. So, for example, the example I like to use a lot is I talk to so many of my
But can you hold that, Julie? We have to take a quick break here. We're just a couple seconds out, but I really want to hear this. Folks, Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. Can we bring social justice to the food chain? Make food just for all. What do you think? 831-479-1080. We will be right back with Julie Guthman and you.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, What's Eating What? You know, folks, talking with Julie Guthman about a speech she gave at Northampton Community College in May, in which she said, "We must also make food justice more culturally relevant. The organic food movement has not resonated with people of color." Come to thinking about that, first of all, I don't think it resonated with anybody when it first started. Everybody looked at this whole phenomenon of organic foods and said, "What a bunch of crazy hippies." And it took a long time, a couple decades, before it grew to the extent that it now threatens the existence of those big brands. And so, you know, with respect to people of color, would that not be the same thing? Would it just not take some time to reach into their culture and talk to them about the nature of their food to the extent that they might understand it? Julie?
Well, I want to say that since I started discussing this particular critique, and I'm not taking credit for this, but in the last 5 or 10 years, there's many, many, many more people of color involved in alternative food movements, but on their own terms. But here's the thing, and here's where I got this observation. I work in community studies, as you know, and it's a major where students do field studies with social justice and social change organizations. And I've worked with many students who have gone to work in community gardens or in produce delivery services where the intention is to bring this good food to others, as I wrote in an article, is to encourage people of color, and particularly African-American communities, to embrace this food. And what I kept hearing from my students as they'd come back from these field studies is that, you know, the people were rejecting, or they're saying, "I just want a Safeway in my neighborhood because I don't even have that." Or they'd say,
I don't want to work in the garden. That's slavery. And so a lot of this, you know, I hear my students, and my students have changed too, but I've heard my students say, I just want to put my hands in the soil. And for many people with histories where farming was slavery, that's not something that excites them. So that critique, I've started making that critique maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and it was really in conversation with my students and with food activists who were noticing that these kind of, the way alternative food was being practiced was not taking hold in communities of color because of this kind of sense that it was what white people do. Now, I think that's changed tremendously, and in part it's changed because people of color have taken leadership in these organizations and or started their own organizations and really changed how they talk about the food and why they're doing it.
How would you suggest that social activism or political activism would address that issue?
Well, in that case, I think it's about having movements and organizations being led by people with less privilege and who have a real stake in, you know, whether there's a supermarket or whatever store in their community. So, you know, I don't know. You seem to be using the term activism in a very narrow way, that it's referring to only protest march. And
I don't mean that at all. I mean, okay. what would we do? What would I do in an activist sort of way to change that dynamic to bring good food to the awareness of whatever people of whatever color?
I would say it's more indirect. I mean, for me, it's not only having different sorts of leadership and changing the idioms of organizations like that, but I also think in a broader way, we need to think really clearly about why certain communities of color do not have the same food access. Why, for instance, there's not grocery stores in their neighborhood if they've been, you know, often because their banks won't lend in particular neighborhoods because there's insufficient income. And so then it really does require thinking about income and wages and food assistance. And so in that sort of way, the activism becomes about the policy environment, about ensuring that food assistance programs continue and become even more robust or something like that. So I don't think you as an activist can go change how somebody in a community garden is thinking about the meaning of their work. I don't think that's the point. But you as an activist, as let's say a white activist in this case, might be thinking about, well, what else can I do to ensure that there's food in that neighborhood? And part of it is thinking about our tax systems and our income systems so there's aren't neighborhoods that are completely deprived of resources.
Well, how would I think that? What would I do? How would I change the income system?
I think we should be working for higher wages. I think we should be raising our minimum wages. I think when the next farm bill comes up, and surely there will be calls to cut food assistance, we should be writing our Congress people and saying, no, you can't cut food assistance. You need to bolster food assistance. Those are the sorts of things I think need to happen for a more just food system.
Do you think giving people more food helps them?
I think everybody needs adequate, nutritious food. What do you mean more food?
I'm not sure. I'm just thinking about... Well, I'm out of thought because I have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like to ask you the big question. Can we do political activism? Can make it our food chain more just? Right back.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends, do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge 2 local bucks each day. Get 2 others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, and you know, before the last break, I kind of fumbled about and asked Julie Guthman, our guest today, about, you know, if we give people food, does it help them? And a quick explanation, I've been watching Venezuela for quite some time as somebody who's fascinated with food and the food chain. And Venezuela at one time grew and produced 75% of its own food. And then it seems the government started helping everybody by giving them free food. And now Venezuela is starving to the extent that it's eating zoo animals. And I guess that's what I was getting at. Do we really help people when we feed them, Julie?
Oh, you were talking about giving away food, and I'm talking about, when I talk about food assistance, I'm talking about income assistance, so people can buy the food they need. Because what we see over and over again is people that are below the poverty line eat very poorly. They don't buy the best, most nutritious food because it's often not affordable. So it's about supplementing income so people can buy it.
But wasn't that what Venezuela did? Isn't that exactly what Venezuela did? It had all this oil, it had all this money, and said, "Here, everybody, you don't have to."
I'm not in a position to analyze the Venezuelan economy at the drop of a hat at the moment.
Okay.
But, but you know, there's been, you know, it, within the United States, we've seen that food assistance, robust food assistance, makes for better diets. And so we should be doing that.
Well, as a student, I had food assistance, so who am I to knock it? You know, that's for sure.
There you go.
So how do we, you know, approach political activism to make our food system better? We just have a couple of minutes, Julie, but...
Sure. Well, you know, here's what I want to say, is that, the food movement has done amazing things. I think that the organic movement has shown how you can grow food in more sustainable ways. And, you know, food's on the agenda in the last 10 or 15 years like nothing I would have ever predicted. And that's all to the good. But what I've seen is a lot of the food activism that currently exists, and this is from working with my students, is very focused on gardening and education programs and on a really limited group, limited kind of activities that I don't think are truly transformative. So for me, a food activism needs to be focusing on those who are the least privileged, who are the possibly the most affected negatively by the existing food system, and work in ways that supports that kind of work. And that's what this book is about. This is a lot of what I teach about. This is what a lot of my writing is about, is encouraging people to think beyond market choices to other ways in which we can affect the food system. And
maybe go kick a politician in the butt?
Well, yeah, sure. We should be pushing our politicians to work more, you know, more diligently toward, you know,
I like the idea of everybody kicking a politician in the butt. Julie Guthman.
I would put it that way. Yes, okay.
Julie Guthman, thank you so much for joining us. The book again?
The New Food Activism.
The New Food Activism. Thank you very much, Julie. Look forward to your book on strawberries. See you soon. Okay. Hey, folks, remember Michael First Law of the Food Chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.